This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the United States reacted in many ways. One decision was to go after the terrorists who perpetrated the attacks. In some cases, terrorists were killed, but many were captured and sent to a prison at our naval base at Guantanamo, Cuba. All of this began nearly 11 years ago. In that time, we have fought two wars, built the country's tallest building on the site of the Ground Zero attacks on the World Trade Center, and those who lost loved ones have gone on about the difficult task of rebuilding their lives. But our collection of terrorist prisoners languish at Guantanamo, many without benefit of trial. For Jess Braven, justice has become a specialty. He covers the Supreme Court for the Wall Street Journal, was awarded for his coverage of the International Criminal Court, and received the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award for coverage of the legal response to 9/11. He has done extensive reporting on the post-9/11 military commissions at Guantanamo since 2001 and is author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Mr. Braven joins us for the hour along with the Honorable Stuart Couch, a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel and helicopter pilot. He was assigned to prosecute, I hope I say his name correctly, Guantanamo Bay prisoner Mohamedou Slahi, excuse me, a man considered not only to be a terrorist, but the one at Guantanamo with the most blood on his hand. But Couch, who now serves as a federal immigration judge in Charlotte, elected not to prosecute Slahi. Both men join us to talk about the case and the ongoing situation at Guantanamo. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
Before we start, we want to mention that the two of you will be appearing at UNC Charlotte Student Union tomorrow morning at 9:30. It's free. It's open to the public. And we want to thank UNC Charlotte for making both of you available to us in advance. And, in fact, Jess Braven will be signing his book at 6 p.m. Friday at Park Road Books. Are the men in prison at Guantanamo considered prisoners of war? Are they enemy combatants? What are they? How do we view them legally in this country?
It's Jess here, Mike. Well, right now the term of art that the Obama administration uses is law of war detainees. The Bush administration called them unlawful enemy combatants. And they're held there under the common law powers of any country at war to hold enemy fighters. But they're all classified, or at least they're classified differently. Only about 20 of them are slated for eventual trial by military commission, the offshore justice system that was conceived by President Bush and continued in modified form by President Obama. The others are either slated for transfer or they are in an indefinite detention. They're considered not prosecutable, mainly because of problems with the evidence, but they're considered too dangerous to release. So you have really three categories of people who are held at Guantanamo right now.
So you mentioned that this is the way things are done in times of war. Eventually, these wars will be over. The one in Iraq is. We're about to exit Afghanistan, and I believe, I could be wrong about this, I believe that President Obama has stopped using the term war on terror. Never a declared war officially by Congress. So at what point do these camps become technically illegal?
Well, I don't know that we could say they're technically illegal. We do know, however, that lawyers for the detainees are making the argument that when combat operations end in Afghanistan, as they're scheduled to do at the end of this year, then the government's power to hold people as a consequence of that war will also end. We don't know how the courts are going to look at that argument, but we know that the Justice Department is concerned that there may be some validity to it, and that is part of the reason the Obama administration is trying to reduce the population at Guantanamo Bay.
You mentioned that 20 are slated for trial. The others are not because there's not enough evidence, but they're considered to be too dangerous to release. How many people are we talking about, all told?
Total, it's about 140 right now. The administration transferred someone to Algeria earlier this month, so it's about 140.
And how many have been there over the course of the last 11 years?
Most of them have been there over the course of the last, actually, since 12 years, really, since January of 2002. That's when the first prisoners were taken there. There were a small number of people who were considered the most dangerous who were held by the CIA in the famous black sites who were transferred there in 2006. They were held in custody elsewhere around the world at secret locations. But most of the people there have been there for more than a decade.
And over the course of time, how many people have we released because we realized we didn't have the evidence, or we realized, in fact, that they were not guilty of anything? How many have we released?
Well, there are also other reasons why people were released, and those are essentially political reasons, because the United States wanted to repay favors to other countries, whether they were the United Kingdom, a close ally, or countries like Morocco, who also provided services to the United States. So it's not simply because there wasn't evidence. Some of the people who were released were it was simply a political or diplomatic trade or favor. But over the course of the prison camp's history, nearly 700 people have been held there, not at one time, but over this, they've been most were taken and released during the Bush administration. But so you could say 700 to 800 were held overall at that camp since it opened in January of 2002.
I think, Mike, and let me just preface this by saying my comments here on the show today are my personal opinion, and they do not reflect the positions of the United States Department of Justice or United States government. To my knowledge, I think the high watermark of detainees there, the number was 790. Roughly, that's 650 that I believe have been repatriated. The most recent addition, I think, to Guantanamo, the most recent detainee that came there, I believe, was back in 2006, if I remember correctly.
Is there an historical precedent for the amount of time that we have kept prisoners without benefit of trial anywhere in this country, or rounded them up in the way that we got these prisoners into Guantanamo anywhere in this country for any reason before?
No. To my knowledge, no. I'll preface this by saying the United States Supreme Court, by my count, on at least three different decisions going back to 2003, have stated that the under international law, the United States can hold these combatants to the end of hostilities. And so they've reconfirmed that.
Mm-hmm.
So that would lead us to believe that under the doctrine of preventive detention, that these 140 detainees that are still at Guantanamo conceivably could be held until, quote unquote, the end of hostilities. The troublesome thing, and I think Jess alluded to this a moment ago, the troublesome thing is, what is the end of hostilities, given the unique nature and asymmetrical nature of the combat and warfare that we're now involved
in. So technically, it could be argued that, for instance, if this disappearance of this airplane in the South Pacific turns out to be an act of terrorism, we could point to that as an ongoing part of the conflict.
Right. But the difference between the situation we face today and the conflicts that we have had in the history of the nation are that we are dealing with what we call a non-state actor. That is, Al-Qaeda does not represent a particular nation, or a nation state. It's more of an idea. And so that's where it gets murky in these determinations of preventive detention.
When Guantanamo first began to take these prisoners into custody, we know that they were not technically prepared for the influx of people. So they put them literally in chain link outdoor cages. That has changed over the course of the last 11 years. What are the conditions that these people are being held in?
I do have one anecdote that would preface a more thorough answer to that. I know of a Marine judge advocate, and he was a major at the time, and was in Afghanistan in 2001, right after we invaded in October. He gets a warning order and says, you have 48 hours to set up a detention area for detainees that have been captured on the battlefield. And this Marine judge advocate, with the help of the other Marines he was there with, they set up a detention area in an old Soviet hangar there at Bagram, Afghanistan. And they provided sleeping bags, food, mm-hmm. medical care, all of that put together within 48 hours. That's just the nature of the fluid environment that you have on the battlefield. Guantanamo, the Camp X-Ray, as it was originally known, was on the site of a detention area that had been used for Haitians approximately a decade before when they were fleeing Haiti. So the original photographs that we still see in the media of chain link fences and detainees clad in orange and handlers and so forth, you know, those were sort of an expedient, having to get the detention area together in a relatively short amount of time. And I know the general that did that, Mike Leonard, retired Major General, he had about a month to put that detention.
But we have since gone on and built essentially what is a prison.
Yeah, that's right, Mike. Right now, the United States built a near-permanent prison facility there. So if you were an inmate there, it would seem similar to being held in a prison on the U.S. mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several different camps depending on how compliant the detainees are considered. They wear different color uniforms depending on how compliant the guard force considers them to be. The people who are being held for trial are segregated, and they have in generally more restrictive conditions. They don't get to circulate with the general population. There's a top secret camp where the alleged 9/11 perpetrators, the surviving ones, are being held. So it looks much more like a permanent facility now, but the Pentagon says that if we really want to make it a permanent facility, we're going to have to spend millions more to upgrade it and replace some of the facilities that have been built.
We're talking about Guantanamo and our situation there with our prisoners at the base at Guantanamo Bay on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. How did most of these detainees come to be our prisoners? In other words, how did we obtain them? How did they, were they just snatched off the streets in various countries and put on a ship and sent over here?
The vast majority of them were captured in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
After we put boots on the ground in October. It's my understanding also that the Northern Alliance, which was a group in opposition to the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2001 that allied themselves with the American forces, collected up some of these foreign fighters. And so one of the first stark realities that I observed when I began working on these cases in 2003 was that they're clearly not all Afghani. In fact, vast majority of them were Saudi Arabians, Yemenis, a few Moroccans. At one point, we actually had an Australian. We had five British citizens. So they really came from several different countries. I believe, if my memory serves correctly, there were over 16 countries represented amongst those original 790.
But how did we get them? How did we snatch them?
Captured on the battlefield. Also,
many of them, though, were captured actually by the by the Pakistanis when they crossed the border. Many of them, as you say, were turned in because the United States offered a bounty to the capture of Arab fighters in Afghanistan, and so this was an incentive for the Afghan militias to round up any Arabs they found there and turn them over to the United States, and that is why so many have been released over the period of years, and why about half the ones who are held there now have been cleared for release, and that's because we were really scooping up people relatively indiscriminately. If our forces on the ground had to make a judgment about should we hold someone or not, it's understandable that they would make the default judgment to hold someone.
We have to take a break, Jess Braven. I'm sorry, we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our prisoners of war in Guantanamo, and we'll get into a particular story about one of our guests today, former Lieutenant Colonel, retired Stuart Couch, who was sent to prosecute Mohamedou Ould-Slahi and elected not to after a period of time, and we'll talk about why in a second. Jess Braven is also with us, a staff writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Just to be clear, in a time of war, when you take prisoners of war, and these men are considered to be prisoners of war, it is not, is it, customary to give them a trial? You wait till the conflict is over. Is that right?
Yes. The United States has used military commissions all the way back to the American Revolution. But typically, the military commissions that have been utilized have not been conducted until after hostilities are over.
So why have we been assigning defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys and taking some of these people, preparing some of these people for trial?
That's a very difficult question for me to answer in the fact that my perspective was as one of the worker bees, as one of the prosecutors. However, in retrospect, I believe that one of the reasons the Bush administration made the decision to go ahead and begin conducting military commissions was really in the national interest of trying to assure the public that the people that had committed or were related to those horrific acts on 9/11 would be brought to justice. Mm-hmm. At the inception of military commissions, the idea was that this was going to be quick justice. This was going to be a form of justice that was not going to be bogged down with years and years of litigation, as we do more often in Article III or federal prosecutions. Unfortunately, I think their crystal ball was a little hazy, and these cases are taking much longer.
When you say that, it doesn't jive with some of the other things that we've come to know about Guantanamo, about treatment of prisoners, for instance, at Abu Ghraib. On the one hand, we want to assure the Bush administration wanted to assure the American people that this is going to be on the up and up. On the other hand, there has been torture and things like that, which have led you. That's the principal reason you elected not to prosecute this man, because he'd been tortured.
Well, yes, that's right.
I wonder if I could jump in for a second, sure. Mike, before we get to this very compelling case about prisoner 760, Mr. Slahi, and to give a slight bit of historical perspective. There have been trials during wartime. Historically, there have been some. There was the one that the administration cited as the granddaddy of them all, the trial of a British spy named Major Andre, took place during the Revolutionary War. There was a trial of Nazi saboteurs in 1942, which was, of course, during World War II. There were other trials during World War II of enemy agents and saboteurs. So there have been some historically. I think that the program that began under the Bush administration, though, is quite different from the ones that began or took place in earlier conflicts. And that's because it was conceived as a permanent, freestanding alternative justice system for enemy aliens. It was not an ad hoc thing imagined to be just sort of put together for to deal with an immediate contingency. And also, it was designed really for a different reason than the military trials that were held during the Civil War or World War II. And that's because it wasn't a response to conditions in the field. It was really more a sort of top-down concept to lay out the outer bounds of the president's flexibility and power to respond to the 9/11 attacks. And once the administration laid out the legal framework it believed allowed it to set up this alternative justice system, it really, I would say, at the highest echelons, lost interest in it and moved on to other things, such as the war in Iraq. And that is, I would believe, the principal reason that trials languished for years, because the White House essentially had accomplished its mission of asserting its power to hold these trials. It then outsourced them to the Pentagon, that was reluctant initially to conduct these trials, but it did go ahead and went through the mechanics of putting them together, and that's how Colonel Couch got involved as one of the officers brought in to carry out this policy. But the Bush administration was in no hurry to try the 9/11 suspects. It held them in secret prisons for years until a Supreme Court decision required them to end that secret detention because it violated the Geneva Conventions.
I would only add this one point, and this perhaps sounds a bit cynical, and this is in retrospect. I believe that the idea of military commissions was put forward in 2001 simultaneously with the decision to bring detainees to Guantanamo Bay. I believe to some degree as a rationalization, if you will, some sort of public rationalization for detaining people at Guantanamo Bay and the intelligence effort. Sometimes I felt like our military commissions were a sort of a storefront operation, just sort of a ruse to rationalize holding detainees at Guantanamo Bay if there was the prospect that they were going to be prosecuted at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of my tenure in 2006, fairly jaded by that point, that in fact, no, this was just sort of a veneer, if you will, for the overall intelligence effort.
Some of the inmates there have been staging a hunger strike. How long has that been going on?
There have been periodic hunger strikes at that base, but the one that's currently in play actually began about a year ago. And it is, in fact, what eventually generated enough headlines to catch the president's attention and lead him to renew his effort to close the prison.
One striker, who is a Yemeni national who has been in custody since 2002, wrote an open letter to Al Jazeera to explain both the protest there and expose his treatment. He wrote, "With President Barack Obama's blessing, Colonel Bogdan, the warden at Guantanamo, has instituted humiliating groin searches, especially when we are taken for phone calls with our lawyers or families. He's withheld medical treatment and confiscated our legal papers and Korans. Because I decided to protest my imprisonment here through a hunger strike, the special mattress prescribed for my chronic back pain, all of my underwear, my electric razor, even my bar of soap and toothbrush have been confiscated." And then he goes on to complain about the force feeding he's had to endure and his treatment by the guards. Any truth to this? Or is this just an open letter to Al Jazeera?
It's probably mainly true. I think the White House doesn't micromanage how the military runs its prison. They don't. They leave that to the discretion.
Why not? Given Abu Ghraib and some of the other things that we found out about what's been going on historically at Guantanamo, why isn't the White House taking a more active role?
Well, I think it's very important to distinguish between what's going on now in detention, even if it is harsh detention, from what took place at Abu Ghraib, and also what took place in the authorized interrogation programs, which the president and others have classified as torture. You've got a maximum security prison, and the guards there take very strong precautions, many of which the detainees object to and their lawyers object to,
mm-hmm.
but they're not on the order of the humiliating torture and degrading abuse that took place earlier in the conflict. But yes, the conditions of confinement are a constant dispute between detainees, their lawyers, and the prison warden. I don't think it's harsh as they are. You can't really compare them to the types of abuse that are both that took place when some inmates were held by the CIA, and also took place in some circumstances by military interrogators, including what happened to the detainee you mentioned before, Muhammadu Slahi, who was subjected to things that were part of an interrogation program that amounted to torture, and that's very different from the what I'd call maximum security, whether it's justifiable or not, harsh conditions, but nothing really approaching the kind of torture or degrading or humiliating treatment we saw earlier.
So let's get into that. You were sent to Guantanamo as a military prosecutor. You lost a friend in the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. He was a pilot or a co-pilot in one of the airplanes that crashed into one of the towers, correct?
That's correct. I guess I did have to correct a little something on your biography at the outset. I was a C-130 pilot, and I flew out of Cherry Point, North Carolina. One of my squadron mates was Mike Horrocks. And about the time I left to go to law school in 1993, about a year after that, I believe Mike left active duty to become an airline pilot for United Airlines, and he was the co-pilot on United Flight 175, which was the second plane to hit the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11.
So you have a personal connection to wanting to get these guys, to wanting to get the bad guys, the perpetrators to all this. So you wanted to go and be part of this investigation and this prosecution.
I did. In 2001... I was was in the reserves at that point, but happened to be on active duty for a short amount of time at Camp Lejeune. And then when 9/11 went down, we all realized that we would be going to war. And after the president signed his military order in November of 2001, they put together the prosecution teams, and I was one of the individuals that they that they asked to participate.
And you arrived at Guantanamo in 2003 and almost immediately were disturbed by some of the things that you saw there. What did you see?
I was actually assigned to Washington, D.C. We had a satellite office in Guantanamo and would frequently travel from D.C. to Guantanamo. Okay. And that really exists to this day. That's been part of the problem with the military commissions is this back and forth between Washington and Guantanamo. In October of 2003, I went to Guantanamo for the first time to become familiar with the surroundings, to see the detention area. I needed to do that as a prosecutor because the information that built the vast majority of our cases came from these intelligence reports that came out of the interrogations and the interviews of the detainees. I was waiting to watch an interview with a detainee, actually, incidentally, an individual that just pled guilty a couple of weeks ago. I was there to watch his interview, and before they brought him in, I heard this heavy metal music blaring down the hallway of this detention trailer that we were in. I walked down the hall. I thought it was some guards that had a boombox turned up or something like that, and we're going to tell them to turn it off. And as I rounded the corner where the music was coming from, I noticed the room was black with the exception of a strobe light blinking in the room. Mm-hmm. And they had these huge speakers where this heavy metal music was coming out of, and it was really loud. And then I noticed the detainee was seated on the floor in the corner, shackled with his hands to his feet, and he was rocking back and forth, and his lips were moving, which I interpreted that he was praying. These two civilians, they clearly not military because of their dress and their grooming and so forth, sort of blocked my view and asked, you know, who I was, and I told them I was Colonel Couch. And I said, you know, you need to turn that down. And they just said, move along and close the door in my face.
So who were they who would talk to a military officer like that?
Well,
who were they?
That I can tell now in retrospect, most likely they were either contractors or civilian employees to the
And they can speak
Department
to a military
Defense.
Officer like that?
Well, that was part of why I realized there was something weird happening in this situation. There was a Air Force captain with me at the time, a JAG himself, and I said, well, did you see that? And he said, well, it's approved.
So let's be clear. What disturbed you about that? Was it the loud music? Was it the fact that he was shackled with his feet chained to his hands and sitting on the floor? What was the disturbing part of that for you? Because the guys in the room with him were listening to the music, too.
Well, the disturbing part of it was, again, because I had been a pilot. I'd gone to training when I was a pilot years before. It's called SEER School. It stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It's a school that the various military, the different services have their own schools. I went to the one run by the Navy in Brunswick, Maine. And it's a school where they teach you the conditions that you should expect to endure if you are ever taken captive by an enemy as an aviator. It's built upon our experiences of what happened to our aviators predominantly in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, John McCain's story is prime among them. What you learn at that school is that if you are taken captive, you have to assume that your captors will not abide by the Geneva Conventions. They will not that you will be humiliated, you'll be treated cruelly, and in some instances you'll be tortured, and that the information that they're after is not necessarily actionable intelligence. The information they're after is more on the lines of propaganda. So that they can use it in a propaganda war, as the Vietnamese did during the Vietnam conflict. So based upon my own experience, having gone through that week-long training where I was humiliated, strip-searched, interrogated, physically assaulted, kept in a cell with music and strobe lights, when I saw this, I immediately realized this is right out of the SEER School playbook.
We're talking about Guantanamo and our treatment of prisoners there, and at least one particular prison that we'll get into as we go through the program here with Lieutenant Colonel Couch on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You mentioned the Geneva Conventions and that you were told in your training that the people who captured you would probably not follow the Geneva Conventions. Were we following the Geneva Conventions in terms of what you witnessed in that incident and what you learned about the prisoner you came to prosecute?
No, we were not. The immediate response that I had seeing that interrogation was this violates the Geneva Conventions. That as a prosecutor and also having the experience of how they get information at Sears School, as a prosecutor, my first thought was whatever information this individual gives up as a result of this treatment lacks veracity, because you'll say anything. You know, there was this Italian theorist back in the 1600s, Cesare Beccaria, said torture is a certain method for the acquittal of robust villains and for the condemnation of innocent but feeble men. I mean, that's exactly the point. You know, when put in those kind of circumstances, you'll say anything. Mm-hmm. So as a prosecutor, I had a concern about the veracity of any information that would come from an interrogation like that. As an American, I was offended because I felt like it's un-American. You know, we abide by the Geneva Conventions. We're signatories to it. But more important than that, it's consistent with American notions of fair play and justice. And finally, as a Christian, I was just what I saw was abhorrent to me.
I have a minute left in this segment. Before we get into Sly in the next segment, I want to talk just for a second about the Geneva Convention idea here. Is this because, Jess Braven, because we outsourced essentially? We shoved the decision-making about how to treat these people down the chain of command from the White House to the lower levels? Is that why this happened?
Well, yes and no, because the president, President Bush, declared at the outset that the Geneva Conventions would not apply to these prisoners. And that was sending a message broadly throughout the government that they would not have to be treated humanely the way the conventions specify. And it also, however, was the thinking that went on at the very highest levels of government in both the CIA and military intelligence programs, where very aggressive forms of abuse and cruel interrogations were designed, including the reverse engineering of the SEER program that Colonel Couch just mentioned. That program was seen as a way to figure out how to
interrogate. I have to stop you because we're going to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo and about one particular incident, which we're about to get into, with the former Lieutenant Colonel, retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, who is now a federal immigration judge here in Charlotte. He was a prosecutor at Guantanamo. Jess Braven is the writer of a book called The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. They will both be at UNC Charlotte's Student Union tomorrow morning at 9:30 making a presentation. It is free and open to the public. We'll have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. And Jess Braven is signing his book at Park Road Books, 6 p.m. on Friday night. Let's talk about Mahmoud Ould Slahi, the man you were sent to prosecute there. Who is he? What did we believe he did? Because he is the man that you described as somebody who had the most blood on his hands of anybody there.
In 2003, Slahi was considered to be the person with the most blood on his hands at Guantanamo because the other 9/11 detainees were still held by the CIA at the black sites. What we knew about Slahi was that he had lived for many years in Germany. He had a degree in electrical engineering from Duisburg University. He had also lived for several years in Toronto, Canada. And had attended the same mosque as an individual named Ahmed Rassam, who was the Millennium Bomb Plot leader.
Many people might not remember what that is. That was a plan to blow up or set off a bomb at LAX, right?
Correct. And he's been convicted and is now a prisoner at the Colorado Supermax. Mm-hmm. Slahi came to everyone's attention basically when Ramzi Ben al-Sheib. Ramzi Ben al-Sheib was held by the CIA at one of the black sites. Ramzi Ben al-Sheib was the right-hand man for the 9/11 attacks, and he worked directly for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11. So Ramzi basically would do all the bidding for KSM to get the mission done. Ramzi Ben al-Sheib, while he was interrogated, and what we had seen in an intelligence report, said that Slahi, that Ramzi Ben al-Sheib, Ziad Jarrah, and Marwan al-Shehhi, who were two of the 9/11 pilots, hijacker pilots, mm-hmm. that the three of them had met Slahi on a train in Germany, and Slahi had told them that they needed to go to Afghanistan to receive training, and then assisted them in some respects with going to that training in Afghanistan. So Salahi, at the time in Guantanamo in 2003, he was the closest thing to a 9/11 connection that we had, with one other exception. He was the closest 9/11 connection that was actually being held there. The rest of the 9/11 connection detainees being held by the CIA.
In your book, Jess Braven, you report that Salahi was interrogated initially by the FBI, who assured him that we don't beat people, we don't torture, it's not allowed. But they were unable to get him to confirm that the U.S. government believed what the U.S. government believed they knew about him. They viewed him as the key orchestrator of Al-Qaeda in Europe. And the FBI was replaced by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and their treatment was very different. Before we get to that, do you still believe he was the key orchestrator of Al-Qaeda in Europe? Either of you?
Well, he denies that, and so I can't know because I haven't interviewed him and I haven't seen all the evidence. There certainly is enough evidence that he's listed in the 9/11 report. If you look it up, it describes him as recruiting these other members of the Hamburg cell to take part in the 9/11 attacks. Whether he's the key organizer or not, I can't say. I think, though, that this dispute between the FBI and the Defense Department, it is one of the little recognized themes of our post 9/11 response, which is one of bureaucratic rivalry. The FBI had its ways of interrogating suspects, ones that considered pretty successful, and also ones that felt were consistent with what prosecutors need, getting evidence in ways that will stand up in court. But the Defense Department under Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was very eager to take the lead in intelligence gathering as well as military response, and was not patient and did not want to rely on what it considered to be pre-9/11 ways of thinking. And the Defense Department was eager to show that it as well, not just the CIA, could get intelligence from detainees.
If the FBI, and I have a legal expert here at the table, and I have you who's done a lot of research into this, Jess Braven, if the FBI was under the impression that they could not do certain things because of United States law, the military thought they could do those things and still remain under the law?
To back up slightly, part of the reason, in fact, the principal reason that Guantanamo was selected as a detention site was the Bush administration's legal view, erroneous it would turn out, that American law did not apply at Guantanamo Bay. Their belief was that federal courts had no jurisdiction there and no foreign or international courts had jurisdiction there. Therefore, they could do whatever they felt was appropriate without regard to legal restrictions.
Now, you're a federal judge, and I know that you're here speaking your personal opinion and not that of the Department of Justice or the United States government. But if we have a military base that we are leasing from Cuba and therefore it's United States territory, why would not United States law apply?
Well, the people that know about Guantanamo, the military attorneys, at the very outset, we said that'll never hold up because there's a PX, a base exchange, on Guantanamo. And there were people that had shoplifted from the PX and been prosecuted in federal court in Florida. And so if you could prosecute them in federal court for shoplifting at Guantanamo, surely the Article III courts could provide overview for the treatment of detainees.
So the Defense Intelligence Agency used different interrogation methods than the FBI. Strip searches are alleged to have taken place, shaving the head and beard, which we know among Muslim men is not permitted. Water was poured over the head. This particular individual, Salahi, was denigrated, forced to wear signs labeling him as a coward, a liar, a dog, forced to act like a dog, forced to wear a burqa, which means he was humiliated partially sexually, forced to worship a stag idol, and more. Who authorized these tactics? How did we develop these tactics?
Well, I would say with Salahi, I believe that the techniques you just listed were from some other detainees.
Okay.
However,
right.
Salahi, though, was part of what we called the special projects, and that was signed off at Secretary Rumsfeld's level himself. They these were all just sort of glommed together as really humiliation and intimidation was it the crux of it? In Salahi's case, he had some hang-ups about the fact that he couldn't his wife was not pregnant and was unable to impregnate his wife, and so they played off of that, and so that was why there was a lot of sexual innuendo and play in his interrogation techniques.
Some female interrogators, removed their tops, rubbed their breasts against him, fondled his genitals, insulted, laughed at him. There were anal cavity searches conducted on him. He had to endure extreme temperatures. Under conditions like that, what did they expect him to break? Did they expect to get reliable information?
They surely expected to.
It almost sounds sadistic.
Surely they expected to, because that's why they did it. Some of the stuff that I found even more disturbing, however, Mike, was they had a ruse with him. They presented him a fake letter on United States Department of State letterhead, indicating that his mother and his brother had been taken into custody in Mauritania and were being brought to Guantanamo, and voicing concerns about his mother's safety. That fits exactly in the United Nations Convention Against Torture. When you get to the definition of torture, of the insinuation that others will be harmed if the subject doesn't give information.
Well, it's a place that only housed men, and they had been there for quite some time, and the illusion is that they couldn't guarantee that she would not be raped if she was coming here. He was the eighth son of a camel herder. I think, how many sons? There were 13 children, I think. His father had died. His mother had raised the family. She was a heroine to him, and that was bad enough, but the fact that she might be raped was considered to be something above and beyond.
It was. Another.
That was not true. They were not going to bring her here.
No, but it was a ruse. And frankly, it's a ruse that he would believe, given the long period of time of sensory deprivation and psychological pressure that had been brought to bear on him.
So aside from the fact
other
that
big issue for him, though, was they insinuated he was going to be executed.
Uh-huh.
And again, that's another aspect of under the.
And they took him out on a boat.
Right. Led him to believe he was going to be taken to another country to be tortured.
Mm-hmm.
On another occasion, they let him out believing he was going to be executed. Mm-hmm. So all of these things came together. And finally, based upon some of the information that I was provided under the table by my criminal investigator, who got it from the intelligence sources, was the reason I ultimately made the decision not to prosecute.
How long did this go on?
And Mike, I just want to point this out, that this is not information that Colonel Couch, as the official prosecutor representing the United States in a potential criminal proceeding, this is not information that he was given the way that a normal prosecutor would get from the police department regarding their investigation files. This was information that was withheld from the official prosecutor. He only found it out through back channels when he became suspicious about where this information was coming from. So it shows you that the government is actually concealing information about how it is interrogating prisoners, not only from the public, but even from its own prosecutors.
You struggle with the ethical questions. First of all, the information that could be gleaned from somebody under these conditions in most cases is going to be unreliable and probably not true, because they'll say anything to make all of this stop. But you were also concerned because you didn't think it would stand up in a court of law, and you have said that you were concerned as a Christian that this was morally reprehensible and wrong. What were the ramifications to you personally of refusing to prosecute him as a result of this?
Well, in the military, and as a military attorney in particular, your reputation is everything. And but I've really never been concerned about reputation, because I wanted to do what was right. But I did know that there by taking that stance, it was not going to be popular with the chief prosecutor at the time. And as a result, my concerns about that I was correct. He didn't like it. However, it was kind of after we got over his initial anger at me, it was sort of a shut up and color and move on to the next case.
A lot of people would say, we don't care if it violates the UN. We don't care if it violates the Geneva Convention. Look what these people did. We don't care about any of that. And these are the same people who would say, we do care about the Constitution. Does it violate the Constitution in your mind?
Yes, it does.
Do you feel that the interrogators or those who devised and ordered them to act the way they did towards Salahi and other prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere should be prosecuted?
Unfortunately, that is a position that I'll have to expect that others will make. My reservation with it all has been, and my hope has been, that because of the attention brought to this issue, the sunlight that has been shined on it by the media and others, that this country will never again engage in a policy of cruelty. That is, that we will not have a situation.
We have a hunger strike going on now, alleging continued cruelty.
Well, as Jess pointed out, and I think he's correct on this, the detention procedures and policies that are in place now are entirely consistent with those that are found in any federal prison across the United States. So I believe that the one issue I believe that the Guantanamo detainees have is the notion of preventive detention. That is, they are being detained with no end in sight. And as I pointed out earlier, the Supreme Court has affirmed that as a controlling tenet of international law.
We're talking about Guantanamo Bay on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. President Obama.
One of the things,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that there are people who say we don't care about the rights of these detainees given what they've done. Well, there are a couple of responses. One is that we don't know for sure what they've done until they've been fully tried and convicted. So there is a cart before the horse question. You don't normally punish someone before you're assured of their guilt. And here, what we have really is suspicion. And we do know that through trials, sometimes what the government initially alleges or suspects turns out not to be true. The one contested trial that we had at Guantanamo Bay over this entire period was of Osama bin Laden's former driver, and the government alleged tremendous crimes against him. A military jury, six military officers, acquitted him of the most serious charge. They convicted him of a minor charge and sentenced him to 5.5 months plus time served, and he was subsequently released. So there you see that the military itself, when it conducts its own procedures, will sometimes reach a different conclusion than the government alleges at the outset. So that's one question. Just how do we know they're guilty until we have had a trial where the government has to prove what it says about someone?
How did
the
all
second
the...
point, though?
Go ahead.
The second point, though, is really the fact that even if torture worked, and we have disputes over whether it does, the fact is that the United States has made it illegal. So normally, it's as if it's not really an option if the United States has made it illegal, unless we want to repeal the laws that prohibit torture and withdraw from the international treaties that prohibit torture. The fact that it is illegal has imposed a price that we are still paying, because at the 9/11 proceedings that are currently underway, many people may have lost track of this, but there are pretrial hearings going on at Guantanamo periodically for the 9/11 case. The number one issue is the pretrial treatment of these detainees, the United States' intentional infliction of cruelty or torture on these detainees, and whether that damages or to what degree it damages the case against them. And whether or not they will ultimately, if convicted, be subjected to the death penalty.
Jess Braven is a staff writer with the Wall Street Journal and the author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay, which outlines what we've been talking about today and fleshes it out dramatically. Also with us, retired Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch, and now a federal immigration judge here in Charlotte, who refused to prosecute one of these people because of the torture he endured. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.